You're listening to Their Finest Hour, a podcast from the University of Oxford.
The white cliffs of Dover, tomorrow, just you wait and see.
I'm here at the Taylor Institute Library with Emma Huber, who is an expert in German. Is it German manuscripts at the Taylor Library, or is
I'm the German subject librarian at the Taylorian Library, so I'm responsible for our German collections and our special collections.
I just wanted to ask you, Emma, the particular area that you tend to focus on in terms of your own personal, like professional and personal interests, is this modern? Is it tends to be modern German material, or can it be early modern? Is it 19th and 20th century, or can it go back earlier?
It can go back earlier. We've got some German collections from the earliest days of printing, and a pretty impressive collection of Reformation pamphlets as well.
I see. And the particular person that we're here to talk about today is, or was at one point, the Taylor Professor of German at Oxford University, Professor H.G. Fiedler.
Yes, that's right.
And H.G. Fiedler was a contemporary of a number of very influential individuals in early 20th century British and German history, and seemingly was a very important connecting point between Germany and Britain at a time of very tense relations between both those countries, and tried to act as a sort of a conduit for peace, I believe, during the interwar period. I suppose I should begin by asking who was Professor H.G. Fiedler and what was his background?
Okay, so Professor Fiedler came as a teacher of German. He was first of all at the University of Birmingham and then came to the University of Oxford in 1907. His family was involved in culture, music, so he was very, very aware of all the different kinds of sort of culture and wanted to share that with an English audience through his teaching. I think he was a teacher first. He was passionate about his teaching.
Fiedler comes to Oxford around what time? Appointed.
So he's appointed in 1907,
okay.
And he's the first full-time member employed to teach German to the university. Mm-hmm. In modern languages was not something where you could get a degree. I think the first degrees were ordered in 1903, so up until then it had been part of other degree programmes. So the idea of modern languages as a degree that you could study on its own was still quite new.
So he was quite pioneering in this particular sense. He was at a time when modern languages were really being adopted by Anglo-American and also Western European universities. Really, he was coming on the scene at a time, you know, professionally, when there weren't really many appointments in the area of modern languages. He's really kind of, it sounds like he's a trailblazer in that particular sense.
Yes, that's right. It's a new area. It was quite usual for people of German nationality to be appointed to those kind of roles, rather than an English person teaching German. It was normal for a German person to be invited to take those positions.
And this is happening at a time when there's growing tension between the United Kingdom and the Empire and the German Empire. So while opportunities for employment as a young professor of German are presenting themselves for this young professional, Germany and Britain are unfortunately sliding down the gun barrel towards conflict. There's growing tension between the Kaiser and the British government over various aspects of foreign policy. Do we know what Fiedler felt about this or thought about this? Did he have any apprehensions about the onset of conflict this time?
So Professor Fiedler was passionate about the close relationships between the UK and Germany throughout his life. He was very active in setting up all kinds of different things that would bring the two nations together, through exchanges, literary societies, organising concerts. He put on the first German language play here in Oxford. to be performed. So he was absolutely passionate about bringing the countries closer together, and he believed that culture was the way to do it. And he says that in a number of speeches. The first one I've got recorded is from 1910, where he's talking about how culture and understanding other nations is the best way to avoid war. So he's determined that war can be avoided and that the study of languages and cultures is the way to do it.
Is he unique in this particular regard, advocating culture as a means to avoiding war? Is this something unique or perhaps unheard of at this particular time, or is it...
I don't know. I think there was certainly a strong wave of people trying to build bridges at the same time that these tensions that you were talking about. There was equally strong feeling that these bridges needed to be built and the cultures needed to be brought together. And so certainly Fiedler had support in that.
I noticed that you have a document here. This is to do with a particular gathering. It's sort of an Anglo-German gathering, if I'm not mistaken, which involves leading high society members, representatives of the German government, representatives, I suppose, of English society, and you have correspondents of the Times and also the Oxford Times represented at this particular dinner. Could you tell me a little bit about this particular event?
Yes, so this was a celebratory meal given in honour of the German ambassador, Count Lichnowsky. And as you say, there's a large number of the local, all the academic community to do with German, but other dignitaries as well. And this is on the 3rd of June 1914. And it is part of those efforts to bring Germany and England together at what was a time of a great deal of tension between the two countries.
What was the date of that particular gathering?
3rd of June 1914.
And within a month, Europe descended into conflict. By August, Britain and Germany were at war.
Yes, and at least one of the people on the seating plan we know died at the Somme in 1916. But people from that dinner were fighting on both sides.
It's quite extraordinary to behold that, and in view of what was to happen. This is very clearly an attempt, some kind of attempt at... shall we say, a cultural meeting of minds. I think probably many people at that gathering probably couldn't have imagined the nightmare that was about to unfold in Europe, that they would all be participants in one way or another, and the all-consuming nature of that. Did this leave a lasting impression upon Fiedler?
Absolutely. I think the First World War for Fiedler was truly horrific for all the obvious reasons, but also because he had students, friends and colleagues fighting on both sides of the conflict. He was trying to support them, he was trying to support the families. At the same time, he was dealing with articles about that were against his presence in Oxford as a German national. So there were unpleasant articles about him. His position was quite difficult. He was a very popular man, a very charismatic man. He had the support of his superiors, and I don't think his position was ever in danger. And like several of his friends, including his brother-in-law, who lost his position as an academic and was forced to leave the country. So there was all kinds of personal difficult circumstances, but also the tragedy of all those people fighting and dying senselessly, as it must have seemed, on both sides. So his passion for peace and his belief in the ability of culture to avoid conflict was actually strengthened, if anything, by the First World War. Sales of books in German literature went up in the 1920s. More people wanted to study, and Fiedler was absolutely undeterred in his mission to rebuild those bridges that had been so shaken.
By the end of the war, Fiedler had probably been quite considerably shaken by the fact that he had actually lost at least one, not many more, of not only people that he knew, but people who he thought. There's a letter that you shared with me from one of his students who served in the 1st Battalion of the Cambridgeshire Regiment on the Somme, and it's dated the 14th of September 1916, and just a couple of days later, the student was apparently killed in action on the Western Front. Do tell us a little bit about this correspondence.
Yeah, so his surname is Olpas. He was a student of Fiedler, and he was at present at the dinner with the ambassador in 1914. He'd gone on to be a school teacher in the Lake District, and he continued to correspond with Fiedler, and he was working on a book about the Austrian author Gödel-Partzer, and was sending work home to Fiedler while he was at the front in at the Somme. And this letter is talking about that work and how he was nearly at a point where he could send it back to Fiedler. He went missing in action just 2 days after the letter was written, and it turned out later that he had in fact died.
Very deeply tragic. It must have impacted Fiedler greatly. The letter itself is a very, I suppose it's very moving kind of reminder of sort of how fleeting life is really in a time of conflict. But what was remarkable about it, this was one of his students who was passionately committed to the continuation of his study of language, even though particularly to, the subject of Austrian German, I notice, has a particular interest in that. And he's doing this while fighting on a front line against the ally of Austro-Hungary, which is Imperial Germany, who his enemy speaking the same language. Actually, there were Bavarians fighting on that section of the line, so not very dissimilar to the language that he was studying. So it's quite fascinating that he's committed to studying something that is spoken by an enemy that he's trying to fight. The paradoxical nature of this is quite striking.
Yes, and it must have seemed senseless, because he would have had friends on the other side. He'd been a student here. He'd have been a student with Germans who went back to fight on the German side. I know Fiedler lost students on both sides, as well as colleagues. So yes, the whole situation was confusing and must have been very difficult. Very upsetting and very difficult to know how to respond. Fiedler responded by trying to set up education classes for prisoners of war, as did the German ambassador, Count Lichnowsky, on the German side. So that was one positive way that within the situations that they had that they could respond to the senselessness of it.
The letter itself, I'm just looking at it now, so it's dated the 14th of September 1916.
1st Cambridgeshire Regiment, BEF France, 14th of September 1916. Dear Professor Fiedler, I am now out here taking part in the victory, and after 10 weeks of it feel myself quite a veteran. I have got on with a good deal of the Gödel-Partzer, all the notes to the end of Act 4, and a large part of the introduction. I will send it to you when it is finished, and have arranged for you to get it if I get finished first. Please forgive this brief note, but I thought you would like to know what I was doing. Kind regards to Mrs. Fiedler. Yours sincerely, Olpas.
It's a remarkably moving and touching letter from what was clearly a very committed student, very committed to what he was pursuing, and certainly what you pick up off of is the shared passion. It's quite remarkable, really. Was there any follow up from the loss of that student? Any thoughts that Fiedler conveyed about, you know, how he felt about that from any records or?
Not as such, but I have a letter here from Henry Olpas's mother, who is appealing to Fiedler to send him for work. At this point, she thinks he's a prisoner of war, and is asking Fiedler if he can send some work for him to do.
So they didn't know that he had been killed?
No. It says, if news comes through that he is a prisoner, I wondered if you could suggest some work for him, as I fear the most trying part of his imprisonment will be the enforced inaction. So she's asking for him to send some work. And later on, we know that Fiedler did try and work towards providing some sort of activities for prisoners of war. And also he helped publish the work on Gödel-Partzer after the war. So there is a publication that is based on the work that Olpas was doing.
Speaking of prisoners of war, did Fiedler have any contact with the German prisoner of war, German-speaking POW, an interned community in Britain or throughout the Empire?
I think almost certainly yes. All I can tell you is there's three boxes labelled POW, three whole boxes of material which I haven't yet opened. So that's something that needs to be researched. So
there's so much within the Fiedler collection, is something that you were telling me earlier, that has yet to be explored, yet to be properly examined, and it's certainly a postdoc in this, most definitely.
Absolutely.
It's quite fascinating, really, that he's a relatively unknown figure, and yet so finds himself at a, she'll see later, at a very curious sort of nodal connecting point between a variety of different individuals, because, of course, Fiedler is intimately connected to a figure in history that we all know now very well. His bust is just downstairs. This building that we're in now was opened on the 9th of November 1932 by this man. And this man was none other than the then Prince of Wales and future King of England, albeit very briefly, King Edward VIII. Could you tell me a little bit about his connection with Fiedler?
Yes, so Prince Edward studied German here in Oxford with Professor Fiedler as his teacher. We have various correspondence from those days. We've got one saying, apologising for not attending a tutorial, saying he's gone hunting. There's various other correspondence. Fiedler accompanied Prince Edward on a tour of Germany in 1913, visiting various different locations, inspecting the troops. We've got a photograph album of the whole trip, which gives quite an interesting insight of the time. And Fiedler remained close to Prince Edward throughout the rest of his life.
It seems that Edward, from some of the material that you've shown me, he retained a great affection for Fiedler, became very close friends. This is a friendship that seems to last the better part of 20, 30 years? Definitely a quarter of a century, at any rate. In what ways did Edward VIII, or Prince Edward as he was known before he ceded to the throne, in what ways did he involve Fiedler in his royal duties and his later work?
So there's some correspondence that I've come from after he abdicated.
Okay.
Most notably from 1939, when he has asked Fiedler for some help with a radio broadcast that he's going to give in German radio. There is correspondence before that date. I think they obviously stayed in touch. There's a newspaper cuttings. Fiedler's kept cuttings to do with Prince Edward, Edward VIII, throughout that period. There's three albums of newspaper cuttings.
The letter from 1939 is concerning a broadcast that he made on German radio.
So this is from 24 Boulevard Suchet, Paris, 24th of June 1939. Lieber Herr Professor, many thanks for your letter of June 22nd and your good wishes for my birthday, which I greatly appreciate. I am glad to hear that, despite the attitude of the Deutsche Rundfunk, my broadcast message was heard in Germany and that it filtered through with satisfactory reactions. I had not heard of the organisation known as Hanseatic Scholarships, and I'm delighted to know that despite evil propaganda, there are some young Englishmen who are wise and broad-minded enough to take advantage of a year's study in Germany. If only there had been more such organisations and less of the propaganda on both sides, our two countries would not have got themselves into the unfortunate antagonistic state of mind which obtains in some quarters today. I am, however, confident that the solution to this impasse will be found through peaceful negotiation and not war. We are going south next week and shall be back in Paris in October, so do look me up should you be passing by any time after then. Mit besten Grüßen, believe me, yours very sincerely, Edward.
That's quite an affectionate letter, I must say. Seemingly, Fiedler had a very key role in making that broadcast a success. Of course, I suppose when we look back on this now, this is a very, very controversial act that Edward was taking ostensibly on behalf of the country to try and, I suppose, formulate, I suppose, the ingredients of a last-ditch peace. It has helped paint Edward as very much something of a Nazi sympathiser. Does this later come to overshadow Fiedler, or are there other aspects, I suppose, of Fiedler's, you know, his past, his conduct, his connections, which overshadow him in spite of his connection with Edward? Which do you think was more had a more profound effect in terms of how Fiedler is now remembered?
So Fiedler, in his collection, we know this. I don't know the content of that particular radio broadcast.
Yes.
We know in the archive we have a collection of Nazi posters, propaganda posters. We know that Fiedler welcomed authors that were recognised by the Nazi regime. However, we also have letters from people with Jewish families or people who had been forced to flee Germany asking Fiedler for help and thank you letters after he'd given them help finding accommodation and work. So I think the picture is very complicated, and it's not as simple as to dismiss him as a Nazi sympathiser. There's nothing in his own personal life that would suggest he agreed with Nazi principles or ideas. He supported his sister, who became, one of the first women to graduate from the University of Birmingham. He had quite progressive ideas in lots of ways. I think his belief in the power of culture to build bridges possibly led him to policies which are now known as appeasement, because that was his personal philosophy of life.
He has been framed as being such, like many who were involved within the wider Anglo-German appeasement movement that was so prominent in the late 1930s. And when we talk about appeasement, Fiedler has not only a connection with Edward VIII, abdicated King of England at the time, but also the Prime Minister of the day, Neville Chamberlain, who himself was very committed, wedded indeed, to the policy of appeasement and has been viewed in a similar light because of the overtures that he made to Germany, particularly with the Munich Agreement. Could you tell me a little bit about Fiedler's association with Chamberlain and or the offices that he held in the 1930s?
Yes, so with the growing tensions between Germany and England, Fiedler threw himself into the establishment of what he called the Hanseatic Scholarships, which was a fund to enable exchange students to go to Germany and vice versa. And he was trying to set up a committee that would establish these scholarships, and there are letters from the office of Neville Chamberlain approving the initiative and giving it support. There's letters from various different dignitaries in this country and in Germany who are all desperately trying to set this up, I think, as a last-ditch method of trying to avoid conflict and emphasise the similarities between the two countries.
But you describe it as quite a frantic effort, I suppose, because they're conscious that they seem to be running out of time, and a lot of the impatience is coming, it's emanating from the Third Reich, I think, as much as anywhere. So I can imagine that Fiedler probably is a bit exasperated by the constraints that he's under, given the efforts that he's putting in. These are very strenuous efforts to construct almost a cultural programme to lay the foundations for better relations, and it's part of a wider thing which was popular at that time, to engage with Germany in a sympathetic way and not to go down the sort of anti-German road or have a repeat of that kind of rhetoric as was seen in the lead up to the First World War, where Germany and Germans are lampooned and where mutual respect is shown between the countries. It seems that Fiedler is very much championing this. How do his efforts to construct this Hanseatic scholarship and to construct a wider cultural programme to bring the countries together, how did they play out during this time?
So we know some students went in the year 1938-39, and that four students in total applied to go in the year 1939-1940, but presumably weren't able to take that up. So it got some traction. It was established, but obviously was very short lived. Fiedler, although he didn't speak out against the Nazi regime, the German government wanted to give a gift of books to an English institution. Oxford turned that down. There's also, Fiedler was working on a book of German poetry, which was published in 1943, and we have a letter from a publisher who had highlighted that one of the poems had been used in Nazi propaganda, and Fiedler immediately moved to get that poem removed from the collection. Whereas other academics in producing similar books at the time were quite happy to fill them with Nazi-approved Nazi propaganda authors. So I think that throws a slightly different light on Fiedler as well. He may not have been actively speaking out against Nazism, but nor was he going out of his way to support it.
Yeah, seems like a character very much caught between two sort of very conflicting priorities or forces happening simultaneously. On that particular point, is he coming under pressure during the war years? Is he is his position under scrutiny? Is he documented as an enemy alien, for example, like so many German nationals or ex-German nationals were? Was he investigated by the security services? Is there any documentation or any within his correspondence, within his papers, that indicate how he was treated by the authorities during the Second World War?
There is nothing to suggest he was under investigation by the authorities. He'd be retired by that time. Okay. I think he retired in 1936. Okay. But he's seen as someone who is an influential figure who is able to offer help. And he's approached, as I say, by people living in exile in England multiple times as someone who's able to offer support.
So he's a professor emeritus, but a very much well-established and influential professor emeritus at that.
Yes. Yes, okay. I think he was well known within the establishment of the time, a well known figure, and I don't think, especially as his position in the First World War as well, I don't think he was seen as someone who needed to be under investigation.
Do you think he, at a personal level, got to enjoy his retirement? Do we have anything telling us of his feelings, or you know how he was feeling at this particular time? Given the fact that another war had broken out, shattering what he had dreamed of accomplishing,
I think he must have been heartbroken. The archive is mostly unexplored, so there's all kinds of things that I haven't yet read. One thing I have come across is a letter to the King, King George, in 1943, where Fiedler is presenting him with his latest publication, this book of German poetry, and writes to him saying he hoped it reminded him of the Germany that they both loved. So the earlier, maybe even pre-First World War days, at that time when he'd gone on the trip with Prince Edward. So he was in a position where he felt he could present this to the King and that it would be welcomed. But I think it must have been a time of great sadness. And he died, I think, on the 10th of April 1945, so it'd be just before the end of the war.
He actually literally dies just as the war in Europe has come to an end. Also, a noticeably close period of time, within days really, of Adolf Hitler's own demise. Do you think in some ways the enormity of what was taking place during the war, the revelations of German crimes, and also simultaneous with that, the destruction of Germany itself by the Allies towards the end of the war, was that something that he was aware of? Was that something that might have impacted upon him? Do we know anything about that?
I don't know anything about that, I'm afraid.
There's a lot more research that clearly needs to be done into this figure. I notice you have a book here called Hitler Stole... When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit by Judith Kerr. And this is a very famous author. I think people... would know Judith Kerr, more famously for books like The Other Way Around, and there was another one as well.
The Tiger Who Came to Tea is well known. Also The Mog Stories, who's a very well-known children's author.
Yes, very famous. What's Judith Kerr's connection to H.G. Fiedler?
So the book When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit is showing that Judith Kerr's family's journey from or flight from Germany to England via France, and Alfred Kerr was one of the people who wrote to Fiedler asking for help. So after leaving France, they came to England, and after the Battle of Dunkirk, he could no longer write for French newspapers, so he was in England with no source of income, and at that point he writes to Fiedler asking for help. It would be lovely to find out if Fiedler replied, or how Fiedler replied to that request. Unfortunately, we don't know. But we do have a nice letter from Alfred Kerr explaining the family circumstances, explaining their history, their flight from Germany when he lost his German citizenship. So all the events that are recounted in When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit in brief, and then asking Fiedler for some help.
So Fiedler didn't exactly help people escape, so this is where the question marks are raised, but he seemingly has a role in helping people find their feet when they arrive in the country.
Yes.
In what ways does he do this?
So the requests are usually for help with accommodation or finding an academic post somewhere. And there are thank you letters that suggest that he was in fact able to do that. So find both accommodation and work for people. It's hard without going through the archive in greater detail to know the extent of that. But he was certainly known as someone who was in a position of power even during the war, and an influence, and able to help.
What kind of intellectuals and members of the German intelligentsia did he typically help? Were they writers? Were they professors? Were there a whole range of people?
Range of people. So Fiedler was known within the throughout the cultural scene, and there's several famous people that he's known to have met, Einstein being one of them. He's the author. Hauptmann is a friend, a close friend of Fiedler, and in fact one of the characters in Hauptmann's plays is based on Fiedler. And the letter from Alfred Kerr refers back to the good old Hauptmann days when they were obviously together in some sort of group. So there's lots of cultural figures, but also academics.
There's a letter that Fiedler receives from a member of the staff of the propaganda ministry run by Joseph Goebbels, and this letter is received
from 1936.
And who's this letter from?
It's from Dr. Kurt Fiedler, but as far as we know, it's no relation. And it's asking Fiedler, on the basis of his close relationship with King Edward VIII, asking him whether he would be able to write some articles or an article series about his common experiences or joint experiences with the English king. It would be for the German press. I don't know whether Fiedler did in fact write any such articles. Again, more research is needed to find out just the complexity of the relationship between Fiedler and and the regime.
Well, it seems that it seems that he was a figure who was rather caught, in a bind, really, two nations that at times were warring, at times were trying to find a way to solve their differences and to find accommodations that would, mutually benefit the other. He seems like he was really, for a figure that you imagine coming to a sort of a peaceful place like Oxford, being buried within the professional pursuits of an Oxford academic, he seems to be somebody who's rather caught within the eye of the storm.
I think it's an incredibly difficult situation, and someone who works for the university as well, it really brings it home just how almost every day people are caught up in just events that nobody could predict and are just too horrific really to describe. A lot of the correspondence, while describing the terrible things that are happening, as also to do with the just the ongoing appointments of people, getting funding for research. There's a letter from a German academic whose wife is Jewish, talking about the terrible things that she's having to cope with. She has a mental breakdown, she has to go to a sanatorium, and luckily they get an academic post in America and are able to leave. And all this is interspersed with the need to get an academic appointment, the need to find accommodation, normal, very normal academic things that we still discuss today, faculty meetings, this kind of thing, intermixed with just terrible world circumstances.
It's quite extraordinary, and it does seem that the events of history reach very deeply into his life in a way that I suppose few academics, you know, save for, you know, atomic physicists and various others, would have imagined that they would have gotten caught up in circumstances of that nature. It seems that he was a very influential person and clearly somebody that a lot of people regarded very highly.
Yes, he was a very well-loved figure.
And a very valued member of the Oxford University community, no doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. He was loved by his students, he was supported by his colleagues. Yeah, he was a very influential, charismatic man who remained so, despite all of the events that could have led to his downfall, he remained a much-loved figure.
There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover tomorrow, just you wait and see.